Operation Simon.
Part 1.
Operation Simon. If I heard about it, I heard so.
What was it?
I suggest we stop the interview here. What do you say? Why you want it? I'm built so, and I know exactly what I'm able to tell you, and I know exactly where I stop. And here I stop.
Why would you not be able to speak about Operation Cyanide?
Signature and loyalty to my country.
On June 8th, 1967, news spreads around the world which wasn't easy to believe. Unknown attackers target a U.S. military ship in the Mediterranean Sea. After World War II, this was the first time someone had dared to attack the U.S. military. April 30th, 1945, when an all-out rivalry broke out between the Western Allies and the USSR to conquer Berlin, soldiers of the Red Army reached the heart of Nazi Germany sooner than the Americans. With the fall of the city and Adolf Hitler committing suicide, the flames of the horrendous Second War in Europe burnt out. With all the death and destruction, as World War II was coming to an end, the two powerful conquerors could raise their flags on the mountains of soil and ashes and reorganize world order the way they wanted to. The Eastern powerhouse was the USSR, which had the dream of spreading the ideals of communism and saving the masses of the labor force from the oppression of capitalists. And on the other side, the wealthy Western powerhouse, meaning the U.S., was standing on the principles of using capital to create welfare. In the post-war modern era, both rivals tried very hard to win the competition and defeat their tenacious opponent. It was an all-out rivalry, which wasn't very friendly at all. An arms race, the strengthening of military forces and economies, and many other issues had created a battlefield between the two poles, which later became known as the Cold War. It was a time when the East and West would on the surface shake the hands of friendship, but in secret, point their weapons at each other. The Cold War and all its fearsome features took the U.S. and USSR to the brink of war on a number of occasions. But under the shadows of a scary invention, it never turned into an actual armed conflict. It was the dark clouds of nuclear fission and the devastating shadow of the atomic bomb which kept the flames of the Cold War from flaring up. USSR was doing everything in its power to entice the masses toward communist ideals and turn governments into its allies. Of course, the USSR had to some extent succeeded, and communism was rapidly spreading around the world. Many big and small countries added the Red Star of Communism to their flag and stood with the Eastern camp. Communist ideology was rapidly spreading to weaker countries, and the formidable rival of the USSR had to do something to solve this problem. The U.S. wasn't idly sitting by either. With Truman's four-point program and Kennedy's Peace Corps, it tried to neutralize the USSR's plans.
This corps will be a pool of trained men sent overseas by the United States government or through private institutions and organizations to help foreign countries meet their urgent needs for skilled manpower. We will send Americans abroad who are qualified to do a job. It will not be easy. None of the men and women will be paid a salary. They will live at the same level as the citizens of the country which they're sent to, doing the same work, eating the same food, speaking the same language. We're going to put particular emphasis on those men and women who have skills in teaching, agriculture, and in health.
The fact is, the U.S. wanted to create structural transformation and elevate welfare levels in weaker countries to create a bloc against the propaganda of the communists. Back then, the U.S. had no bigger goal than combating communism, so it did everything it could to win the hearts of the countries in need and remind them that the country that is truly worried about global welfare is the U.S., not the Soviet Union. But the battle of the Cold War powerhouses, like any other complicated game, had hidden layers which made the battle hotter and hotter. At a time like this, the center of gravity when it comes to global politics and energy, meaning the Middle East, wasn't spared of the game of choosing sides between the East and the West. The region has always been the battleground for global powers. The USSR got to the Middle East sooner than its rival and had won over the hearts of Arab leaders. The Prime Minister of the USSR was an ally of Gamal Abdel Nasser, Egypt's second president. With the help of Abdel Nasser's influence among Arabs in the region, the Soviets wanted to change the color of the map of the Middle East into the red communist star. The Soviets knew that the entrance gate of the Arab world was Egypt and Abdel Nasser. By raising the ideology of pan-Arabism to unite Arab race, and of course his constant quarrels with its unwanted neighbor, Israel, Nasser had become the hero of Arabs. When Egypt, at the forefront of the Arab world, showed communism the green light, Syria also leaned towards the USSR. Syria had recently united with Egypt and established the United Arab Republic. A short while later, in May 1967, Anwar Sadat, the Speaker of the National Assembly of Egypt, went to Moscow to meet with Soviet Prime Minister Alexei Kosygin. That's where he was told that America's friend, meaning Israel, had gathered a large number of its forces on the Syrian border and the threat of an Israeli attack on the United Arab Republic was serious. The communists were forced to give this mischievous news to Egypt because they thought that military confrontation between the allies of the East and the West in the Middle East would lead to the victory of the Eastern Bloc.
политическом плане, даже если война закончится в ничью,
we believed a war could bring us political gains. Even a stalemate could bring us benefits. Egypt had our backing, both political and military. We thought their forces would demonstrate the benefits of Soviet support. So we were confident that the balance of power in the Middle East would be altered by a localized war.
When Gamal Abdel Nasser received word that Israeli forces had amassed on the Syrian border, he wasted no time. He immediately wrote to the UN and asked the organization to withdraw its peacekeeping forces, which had been stationed on the border of the neighboring countries from the previous war between Egypt and Israel. Nasser wanted to fill up the entire border Egypt had with this unwanted neighbor with his own military forces. It seemed the Soviets' plot for a war between the ideologies of the East and the West in the Middle East had really worked. Nasser took a further step that putting his forces on standby and shut down the strategic straits of Tiran in the Gulf of Aqaba. The straits of Tiran were the only waterway access Israel had with the eastern part of the world. The only passageway for the Israelis to import fuel had been shut down to the Zionists, and with this, war became inevitable.
Ahlan wa sahlan. Ihna musta'iddin lil harb.
Our armed forces are ready for war. The Gulf of Aqaba belongs to Egypt. There is no way that we will allow Israeli ships to pass through. The Jews are threatening war. We tell them hello and welcome. We are ready for war. But there is no way we will give up our rights to the Gulf of Aqaba.
The USSR wanted to prove its friendship to Egypt and, of course, not be left behind from its rival, the US, in equipping its allies in the intelligence field. So, it got to work and laid cables on the seabed from the USSR to Egypt. The purpose was to be able to whisper in the ears of the Egyptians anytime it wanted. When the USSR realized that it's too late, and the war will inevitably happen sooner or later, it ordered its naval forces in the Black Sea to move closer to Egypt's shores. Based on this order, 20 Soviet warships sailed to the east of the Mediterranean and were put on standby position. The USSR didn't want to leave its Arab allies alone in the war against Israel. But on the other front, the US ordered its 6th Fleet based in the Mediterranean to pull back from at least 100 miles from the danger zone. But one of the ships in the 6th Fleet didn't receive the order. As the entire fleet was pulling back, the USS Liberty had received orders to get closer to the Sinai shores. The Liberty was an unarmed naval ship with 45 powerful eavesdropping antennas, tens of advanced data processing and information analysis devices with language experts and professional analysis who were used to listen in on radio communications. The Liberty was getting closer to the crisis region to listen in on what was happening.
If it was broadcast on a radio wave, we could receive it. At any frequency, low frequency, high frequency, medium frequency, very low frequency. If it was out there, we could receive it. If we were listening and we heard a signal and when we looked at it, we couldn't understand it, it was encrypted as well, we'd send it back to NSA and let them hit it with their computers.
The Liberty's confidential messages were radioed to the NSA, the U.S.'s top secret intelligence agency for the analysis and data processing of electric intelligence. On May 22, 1967, and before the beginning of a new mission in the Mediterranean Sea, the Liberty had slowly and steadily left the Norfolk port in the UK for the Guinea Gulf and the Abidjan port in the western shores of Africa. Its mission in this beautiful port in the country of the Ivory Coast was to listen in and find out whether things were going according to the U.S.'s liking or not.
We were sent around the world, wherever there might be a hot spot, to see if we could determine what was going on and if the United States desired any intervention of any sort.
The Liberty was leaving Abidjan port as Israeli forces were in military position and getting ready for action. Of course, the Egyptians were based in the Sinai Desert before them. The Israelis preferred for the issue to resolve without military action, because they weren't ready to fight, and on two different fronts, from the southwest with Egypt and the north and east with Syria and Jordan.
I've been asked by my government to explore what these governments intend to do in order to reopen this international waterway to
what
a situation
of
law.
What do you want the United States to do, sir?
Well, I've come here really to find out what the United States intends to do.
U.S. President Lyndon Johnson asked Israel not to start the war. This is exactly the same thing the USSR told its Arab ally, Egypt, to do. But Egypt had already taken the first step by closing the Straits of Tiran on Israeli ships. Things really got bad when other Arabs joined hands with Abdel Nasser and allied themselves with him in destroying Israel. King Hussein of Jordan was the first to sign a joint defensive alliance with Nasser and put his army under his orders. King Faisal of Saudi Arabia also went to meet with Nasser and pledge him his support. The U.S. wanted to know what secrets about the inevitable war in the Middle East the USSR was whispering in the ears of the Egyptians at any cost. These events were happening as the Liberty was in the Mediterranean and had reached the Rota Naval Station in Spain, so it could add three experts in Russian and Arabic to its crew. In the Israeli camp, the situation was in crisis mode. Egypt from the west, Jordan from the east, and Syria from the north are on standby, awaiting orders from Abdel Nasser to finish Israel off. Levi Eshkol, the Israeli Prime Minister, thought of a surprise attack as the only way to end the crisis and informed his new defense minister, Moshe Dayan, of his opinion. June 5, 1967, was chosen as the day to attack the Arabs. June 5th, 7 in the morning, 180 Israeli fighter jets flew towards Egypt. Only 12 fighter jets were left behind to defend the Israeli skies. Minutes later, Egypt's military airport runways were bombed, and 280 Egyptian military jets on the ground were the targets of Israeli rockets. The Egyptians were so overwhelmingly surprised that they didn't even find the time to start their jet engines.
Fiqh or Jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked among
the Holy Prophet of Islam. Is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant factor.
Imamat yek asl zinde ast dar tarikh Islam.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Nasir Rafi'i. Please stay tuned. Chastity is the key to control one's desire. Once a person came to Imam al-Baghir alayhi salam and said, "I do not do many recommended acts in Islam. However, I do two certain deeds always. First, I earn halal income, and second, I satisfy my sexual desire through halal means and my marriage. Never have I earned haram income, and never have I had illegitimate relations." Upon hearing this, Imam al-Baghir alayhi salam said, "You are among the worshippers of highest ranks. No worship is higher than these two, halal income and halal relation."
رسول خدا هم فرمود فرمود دو چیز من بعد از خودم نگرانم یکی شهوت شکم یکی شهوت قوای جنسی.
Also, Prophet Muhammad, in a narration, stated, "I am worried about two things after my demise. One is the empty stomachs, and the other is the uncontrolled sexual desire. Therefore, we are recommended in our narrations to control what is between our two faq or jaws, which is our tongue or words, and also what is between our two rajl or legs, which is our sexual desire. As a result, we must have control over our desires, and we must observe chastity in all aspects of our lives." Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Nasir Rafi'i. To find out more about this program, log on to our website www.parstoday.com Call of Islam page. We'll leave you in Allah's care and goodbye. Thank you.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight.
Four corporations control 90% of the baby formula market in the United States. Please stay with us for an article in this regard written jointly by Amy Goodman and Dennis Moynihan writers. This article is published under the heading The U.S. Corporate Monopolies Who Stole the Baby's Formula. Here's the story. Last October, a whistleblower sent the FDA a report detailing safety and sanitation violations at the Abbott Nutrition Factory in Sturgis, Michigan, the largest baby formula manufacturing plant in the U.S. It would be months before the FDA took action. Abbott fired the whistleblower. Four babies who had consumed formula from the plant suffered bacterial infections. Two of them died. The FDA could not conclusively link the illnesses or deaths to the plant. In February, Abbott shut down the plant and announced a voluntary recall of its Sturgis-manufactured baby formula. The FDA followed with a product warning. The life-threatening formula shortage was not due to a natural disaster or circumstances beyond Abbott's control. Rather, it is a predictable outcome of corporate greed, a cover-up, and a captured regulatory agency. Four corporations control 90% of the baby formula market in the United States. Abbott Labs, which produces Similac, leads with 40%, followed by Rickett, which makes Enfamil and Lysil at 30% of the market. The Biden administration is facing mounting criticism for its delay in addressing the Sturgis plant's health and safety concerns and for failing to anticipate the formula shortages caused by the plant's closure. In many cases, infant formula is a vital necessity, providing life-saving nutrition for thousands of babies in the U.S., for whom breastfeeding is not possible due to allergies, immune conditions, or other situations. Parents of color are more likely to use formula in the first 3 months of an infant's life than white parents. The whistleblower report was received by the FDA in October, but the whistleblower was not interviewed until December. The whistleblower's report was released publicly last month in a House Appropriations Committee hearing chaired by Democratic Congressmember Rosa DeLauro. The report stated, lax practices, including regulatory violations, were consistently overlooked and described a pervasive fear of retaliation for those who dared to rock the boat. Following the hearing, DeLauro said in a statement, "The FDA is a regulatory agency, period. It is about time they acted like one." David Dayen, executive editor of the American Prospect, explained how these few large corporations obtain their power over the infant formula market with the help of an essential federal program, speaking on the Democracy Now! News Hour. Quote, "The reason is that we have a program called Women, Infants, and Children, the WIC program, and about half of all formula passes through that program and goes to poor families. It's very well intentioned. The government gets very large discounts for purchasing formula and getting it to poor families, but each state does a competitive bidding process with a formula company. And in exchange for those volume discounts, they get market exclusively. So what you end up having is these little monopolies in all 50 states," unquote. Formula is critical for the proper nutrition of many babies, but is generally considered less beneficial than breastfeeding. The Lancet Medical Journal issued a comprehensive series on the benefits of breastfeeding in 2016, finding that the deaths of 823,000 children and 20,000 mothers each year could be averted through universal breastfeeding, along with economic savings of $300 billion. The series confirms the benefits of breastfeeding in fewer infections, increased intelligence, probable protection against overweight and diabetes, and cancer prevention for mothers. Breast milk, the series concludes, makes the world healthier, smarter, and more equal. David Dayen, in his book, Monopolized, Life in the Age of Corporate Power, describes how the U.S. regime has bullied countries in the global south that try to promote breastfeeding over formula. At a 2018 meeting of the UN-affiliated World Health Assembly, Ecuador's proposed resolution to protect, promote, and support breastfeeding was gutted by the U.S. delegation, which threatened to withhold aid to any nation opposing the U.S. stance. The U.S. delegates, Dayen writes, were operating on behalf of the $70 billion deeply concentrated global baby formula industry. After signing a long-delayed consent decree with the FDA, Abbott is expected to reopen its Sturgis plant as soon as this weekend, potentially alleviating the worst of this crisis by the end of July. Meanwhile, this corporate formula cartel profiting off babies' bellies while feeding at the public trough must be reined in, constrained by effective regulation and empowered consumers.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim. Din al-Islam, din al-Azam, ghayru din Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We're going to talk about the rules, Islamic jurisprudential laws about the media, according to Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, we testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that. Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program. And as always, our guest speaker, Sheikh Javid. Sheikh Javid, is it permissible for a man to provide makeup services for women or vice versa?
No, it is absolutely forbidden. Mm-hmm. And of course, in Western countries, it's very much customary, for women to go to men, getting services from men working in the salons, and also for mm-hmm. for men going to such places and getting services from women, and it's absolutely forbidden for either sexes to be touched by someone from the opposite sex, from the opposite gender. Mm-hmm. And it does not make any difference whether the other person who is from the opposite sex mm-hmm. Is doing it, touching the woman's mm-hmm. hair or body or neck or hand, or just, making her up, It is absolutely forbidden. As we said, that it's not permissible for a woman to show her makeup, mm-hmm. let alone going to a man, getting, salon services and getting beautified or waxed, beautified.
Yes.
Or, receiving, for example, a pedicure or a manicure.
Yes.
Manicure by a man or by someone from the opposite sex. It is not permissible.
What about the other way around, like actually men getting some services from women? Because basically, men's hair is not part of their hijab or something like that. Because they shouldn't cover that
because it is, it involves getting touched by the.
If they don't touch it, they just touch it with the machine, like a shaving machine.
It's not permissible. It's not permissible. I'm definitely sure that no religious authority allows a man going to a woman, getting her hair cut, or let's say getting dressed.
That's apparent.
Yes.
But the other way around, like a man getting some shaving services from a woman.
That's what I'm saying, a man going to a woman and getting those services from a woman. Mm-hmm. It's not permissible.
I see. Okay, Sheikh Javid, what about the Islamic law about going to a special saloons? Because you also made hint at it,
Yes.
Some special saloons that give you or offer some services, like, for example, waxing.
Yes.
All right, some of the parts, like the legs or something like that, And what about the Islamic law about women going mm-hmm. to such places and getting their private parts waxed by another person, especially even by women?
You're right. This is unfortunately a very, common practice.
Mm-hmm.
It has become something routine for some women, for some Muslim women going
yes.
to these salons and getting waxed by women. So what does it mean? When a woman goes to such places, she has to uncover her private part to another woman,
mm-hmm.
and she should allow the other person to remove the hair around the genital area. And according to all religious authorities, it's absolutely forbidden for a woman to uncover her private parts and allow another person to remove the unnecessary or the hair. This is waxing in this sense is absolutely forbidden. If a woman wants to someone else to remove the hair, she can, you know, she can go to her husband or ask mm-hmm. her husband to yes. help her remove the hair, and she herself can do it, you know.
Right.
It is, you know, it is haram, generally speaking, for a woman to go to a salon and get the service and clean her hair or get a, you know, remove the hair and uncover
the private
parts.
What if they exclude the private parts?
Okay. If that is the case, of course, for example, if someone has, you know, removes the hair on the legs. On the legs.
There's or the
no
arms.
Objection.
Yeah.
Or the arms.
Or getting manicure or pedicure services.
Yeah, you are right. That's permissible. Uh-huh. That's permissible because for women, you know, to go to a woman and let's say get the hair on the legs removed, it is permissible.
I see.
Yes.
Okay, let's take a short break again, Sheikh Tawbit, and then we'll be back and continue our program of Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Don't go away.
La ilaha illallah, Allahu Akbar.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Tawbit, our guest speaker. We are talking about the Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Tawbit, our guest speaker. We are talking about the rules of the media according to Ayatollah Khamenei. And Sheikh Tawbit, I'm going to ask you a question about movies and moving pictures and cartoons, you know, and the like. What is Ayatollah Khamenei's ruling about looking at the pictures of non-mahram women who are not wearing hijab, or let's say watching some women, you know, appearing on television? And what is the ruling? Is it, you know, related to, or does it depend on, let's say, that women are Muslims or non-Muslims, or whether it's a live program or not?
Well, we should understand that looking at the picture of a non-mahram woman does not have the same ruling of looking at a woman herself.
Right.
So they are different. One is the picture and the other the person herself. So there is no objection to someone seeing a woman's image, unless, of course, looking is accompanied by some kind of lust or by some kind of, you know, pleasure, which a man might want, might seek, you know. And if there is fear of falling victim to the temptation, or the picture belongs, for example, to a Muslim woman who is known to the person. So in such cases, of course, it's not permissible to watch these pictures who are, let's say, you know, who do not wear proper hijab, or who are partially naked. It's not permissible to say. But if the woman is a non-Muslim woman who does not observe hijab, and there is no lust accompanied with looking at the picture, of course, there is no objection. And Grand Ayatollah Khamenei says that as a matter of obligatory precaution, one should not view pictures of non-mahram women on television that are broadcast live, you know. Pictures of women who do not observe proper hijab. You know, there are women who are, for example, you can say they are very much attractive, very much, partially, let's say, naked. They appear on television. They are non-Muslims. So Ayatollah Khamenei says, that as a matter of obligatory precaution, one should avoid viewing these pictures that are broadcast live.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no problem as far as the pictures which are not broadcast live. There's no problem in watching them, mm-hmm. provided that it's not, you know, accompanied with some kind of ill intention, or there's no fear of falling into a sin. And if a person is confident that he will not, you know, fall into a sin, and he is confident that he will not watch the picture which is not broadcast live. With some kind of sexual intention,
I see,
or with lustful intention, there is no objection to him watching those images.
Shashawit, what about some of the sports programs and matches? Usually, they are broadcast live all across the globe,
yes.
Right? And these are sports matches, you know, we are talking about like men, for example, playing soccer, and then. In the even Muslim families, and they are very much attracted to soccer and football, and then they watch it, you know, along with their family members.
Yes.
So, what about the women? Are women allowed or is it permissible for women to watch those sports matches live? While, as we know, men are wearing shorts, basically, right?
Yes.
In their sports, they are not wearing pants. So is it permissible for the women to watch that?
Well, there are two kinds. Watching from close, as far as watching from close is concerned, of course, it's not permissible for a woman to watch a man with barren legs from close. But if the pictures are not broadcast live, there's no objection to a woman watching it without lustful intention, you know. And if she's confident that she will not fall into a sin, there is no objection or there's no problem in watching those pictures.
Mm-hmm.
And of course,
as long as it's not live?
As long as it's not live. Of course, if it is live, then of course, just as I said in one of the previous, in my answer to the previous question, one should avoid watching such pictures as a measure of precaution.
Okay, thank you very much, Shabi. Thank you for listening to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
Rahmanun Rahimun Mannanun Kareemun Salamun Aleemun La ilaha illa hum Ghaffarun وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو وحيد قدير محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.